transform this into a podcast presentation at Hillside Four Square Church in Reno, Nevada.
Continuing our series, the Psalms of Ascent, and today we'll be in Psalm 126 and 127. The Psalms of Ascent, a little bit of background, they are 15 psalms that were sung by pilgrims as the Hebrews had been scattered all over the world. Three times a year, they would make their way back to Jerusalem to celebrate, and they would always do it for big festivals. And they had the festival of Passover, the festival of Pentecost, and the festival of the Tabernacles. And so if you ever get a chance to study what some of these are about, you know, the Passover celebrates the deliverance of Israel from Egypt. And then Pentecost is 50 days after Passover, which means where they get the word Pentecost. And they celebrated the gathering in of some harvest. And then the Tabernacles celebrates the time that they spent in the wilderness. So during the celebration of this particular week, it's really funny. They would all go camping. It's like, let's go pitch tents and just go camp somewhere. Why? Because we want to remember where we came from. And so as Israel is gathering from, when I say Israel, I'm talking about the people of Israel, the Israelites, the Hebrews that have been scattered all over the world. As they're gathering towards Jerusalem, they have a ritual that they sing these psalms. And they sing these psalms because not just it's the time of the year, but because they're declaring. This is a rehearsal. This is a renewal. This is a reminder. This is who we are. This is our commitment. This is our hope. This is our life. And their songs of deliverance, and their songs of hope, and their songs of lament, and their songs asking God to strike out against the enemies, songs of remembering God's mercy, and then asking for mercy, asking for God to, here's what you've done for us before, would you do it again? That's one of the songs we're going to hear today. And so I'm really excited about each of the songs as they get added to our app. And on Saturday night, November 4th, we're going to be having a Psalms of Ascent concert that will be happening here. All of the songs from the entire 15 psalm series will be done that night. It's going to be a lot of fun. Is that at 6:30? 6:30. Yes, 6:30 on the 4th of November. So a lot of my motivation in doing this as a series has been about 5 to 6 years in process. And it really got started by a book written by a guy named Eugene Peterson. He's also responsible for having translated the gospel or the scriptures into the Message Bible. And the name of the book is A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. And it's taken from a quote by a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche. And he's a really interesting guy. He's one of the most influential German philosophers. And he's most famous for having declared, God is dead. And many people thought, well, that's because, you know, he's an atheist. It's like, no, what he was actually saying is, at the time when he was alive, in the like mid-1800s, there was a lot of things that were changing. And the more people discovered things, and they're getting in science, and they're beginning to pursue, there was the French Revolution that led to the establishment of the first secular state in at least Western history, where even written into their constitution is we are separate from God. There is no God involved. And so what Nietzsche was looking at, he says, there's this reliance upon a Judeo-Christian ethic and belief that's been around for hundreds of years. And now we're turning away from that and turning to science and turning to knowledge and turning to human wisdom, to humanism. It's the same type of thing Gene Roddenberry would have believed, the creator of Star Trek. You know, at some point, humanity just evolves away from their need for God to where they can all of a sudden stop fighting with each other, and we don't have wars, and we don't need money because we're not greedy anymore, and we can just be at peace with everyone except for the Klingons. But he says, you know, God is dead, and with it, all of the reliance, all the morals, all the values are gone. And he was bemoaning that because he really wanted there to be something that made life worth living. And he actually went crazy. He lost it. And many people attribute it to the fact that he came up with the idea, nothing matters. I mean, think Ecclesiastes without any hope. Okay? It's like, nothing matters. There's no value in anything. And this is his actual quote. He said, the essential thing in heaven and earth is that there should be a long obedience in the same direction. There thereby results and has always resulted in the long run something which has made life worth living. What makes life worth living? I would posit the idea that it's something that costs us everything. Christianity, life following after Jesus Christ, is not free. People talk, well, the gift of salvation is free. Well, yeah, you don't have to pay for anything. So it's not like you give money and then, okay, now you're a Christian. You can receive the gift of salvation by God's grace through faith in Jesus Christ. But to say it's free would be, you'd be like, I think I got baited and switched. This is hard. Okay? It will cost you your life. Jesus at no point said, everybody come after me. It's easy. It's free. He said, if anybody wants to come after me, you have to lay aside your selfish ambition, take up your cross every single day, and follow me. If you want to save your life, you're going to lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake, you'll find it. What's it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? Who's with me? And a lot of people are like, you know what? I'd like to, but I got to take care of some things at home. Others were like, you know what? My dad's kind of getting sick and he's not really doing well. So I just got to go home, take care of my dad. Another one's like, you know what? I just bought a field. I'm checking it out. So can't. There is a cost of discipleship. And that cost is not something that we pay by earning God's favor or grace. We can't earn that. But the cost is dying to our own ambition and picking up God's for us. He's not going to say, okay, you know what? You said yes to me. So, Andrew, you're going to become a chicken farmer in Battle Mountain, Nevada. And that's the only way you can serve God. Okay? If that's a dream of yours, to become a chicken farmer in Battle Mountain, anybody here? I can just see it now. You go home. Hey, Tiff, guess what? Yeah. You know that whole Intuit thing? I'm out of it. No. Many times we equate something that, like, if I say yes to God, he's going to pick the worst thing in the world to make me do. To, like, prove that I'm loyal to him. No. I mean, older brothers do that kind of thing. We would come up with something like, I want you to prove it. Now, it's simple. God says, do everything like you're doing it for me. Treat other people like you would want to be treated. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Everywhere you go, do what Jesus would be doing if he was standing in your shoes. Because he believes that's exactly what's happening. He has faith and hope and trust in you to be able to live like he would be living on this planet. Crazy, huh? But we make it so complicated. I met Joni when I was 18. She was 17 and got married 19 and 18. I thought, you know, I used to think grand. Like, when we'd celebrate our anniversary, I wanted to take her to get the finest meats or go somewhere, get a really great restaurant. In 28 plus years, we've devolved. Today, after church, we have a date. We're going to the Maverick station at the bottom of the hill. I kid you not. We're looking forward to this so much. Yesterday, I was like, I called her. I said, I want to go to the Maverick. I had a wedding up at the lake. I want to go to the Maverick so bad, but I don't want to go without you, babe. Oh, I love you so much. It's like, yeah. It's simple. It's easy. And my son Joey went there this morning and brought a plethora of food. I was like, this is going to be a good field trip, babe. This is going to be awesome. Her favorite thing to get there is like a macaroni salad. Who eats macaroni salad from like mini markets? Look around. Look around. I'm so excited. I am so excited. I've always said you're weird. She says, no, everybody does that. No, we don't. But John and Heidi got married last week. So this is what you have to look forward to. Yes. Yes, going to congratulate you on that. Very happy. Anyway, Bible, Jesus, Scripture. Okay, main theme of Psalms of Ascent is perseverance. And if you've ever had to travel any length of time by foot, you learn that walking gets old after, say, 20 minutes, usually. If you're walking with friends, maybe it's a little bit more, you get distracted. But at some point, you... In this walk, people are traveling, you know, potentially hundreds of miles. It's going to take them quite a while to actually get where they're going. I can imagine at some point, especially after you've just celebrated the Passover and Pentecost comes just 50 days later, you're looking at your schedule. It's like, I got to travel back to Jerusalem. Do we really want to make the walk again? It's like, no, this is really important. The meaning of life stuff is important enough to do stuff that costs us our time, our energy, our effort, our investment. In this perseverance, they learned that, yeah, the steps of the journey may be difficult, they may be challenging, they may be hard for us, but it's worth it. Gore Vidal said, "Today's passion for the immediate and the casual opposes the idea of something that requires much over time. The Psalms of Ascent remind us that we get something over time that we cannot just acquire like that." Over the last couple of weeks as I've been teaching on this, I've used the picture of we can be tourists or we can be pilgrims. And if we want to be tourists in the relation in our relationship to God, we're going to only go to see the high points, look at the happy things, and you know, kind of call it good. If we want to be pilgrims, it's going to be something where we actually have to invest ourselves and invest our life. Many years ago, Joni and I were working in Germany. And while we were there, we were given a trip to Rome. Given. That's awesome. Like 4 days. Yes. It was amazing. And so while we were in Rome, my major in college was history. And so I'm thinking I would love to go see some of the stuff in Rome that I've always wanted to look at. You know, the Colosseum, which was built with the wreckage of the Jewish temple. I didn't know that going in. When Jerusalem was destroyed, they took the temple parts and made the Colosseum to kill the Christians inside. Bizarre. We also went to the Sistine Chapel. We went to Vatican City. And I can remember as we're waiting in this line to get into the St. Peter's Basilica, it's like four football fields inside there, if they'd invented football back then. But it's this huge, monstrous thing. And I'm walking around looking at stuff. And after a while, I was so overcome and overwhelmed with all the art and all the statues and how ornate everything was, and got tired of tripping over people because Sistine Chapel, they paint on the ceiling, so people are laying on the ground. And we're walking around the Sistine Chapel, and kid you not, as people are laying on the ground, everybody else is going around like this. And you got people falling all over each other. And it thought if it happened once or twice, that'd be enough, but it's like they're dominoes just everywhere. And I can remember coming out of the basilica. And the only thing I could think of is, I hope we can find a bathroom quickly, because there wasn't one inside for some reason. And I can remember coming out into what had been a completely empty courtyard was jam-packed with people, full. I'm thinking, what's going on here? And I look over, and oh, hey, it's the Pope. He's up on his little balcony, and he's doing his homina, homina, whatever he's saying. I don't speak Latin. But he's doing the Mass. And all I can think is, well, I can say I saw the Pope, you know, and we made our way out of there. And I can tell you, there were people who had been standing in that particular area waiting for the Pope to come do Mass. And they're devoted and investing themselves in this. And for me, I'm looking at it thinking, okay, I saw it. I don't need to stick around because, you know, it's not my thing. I'm not going to – I can just say I saw it. And we left. Found a restroom. Thank the Lord. And looking at it thinking – there were probably people who would have looked at us like we had somehow done something very sacrilegious, because it's the Pope. And for some people, he's like the Pope. Like the big deal. The papa with the big hats. Okay, there it's like a big thing. And for us, I respect that. But it was not like I wanted to stick around and hear him talk in a language I didn't understand. And so we left. If we go through our religious life, like I went through St. Peter's Basilica courtyard, we will pick up some high points. We'll see some cool stuff. We won't see something that changes us. That makes sense? So as a part of this process, recognize this isn't going to happen in 2 weeks. It's going to happen over a lifetime. So disciples get to identify and resist the world's ways and means. So one of the things we can do is kind of pick out, how does our world work? How does our world run contrary to the things of God? Then, once I realize how the world works, I can actively resist it. The problem with the way the world works is it usually doesn't come out and say, hello, this is very evil. I want you to invest everything in this. The devil never has showed up on my front door and said, hi, here to steal, kill, destroy. You got a minute? It's never happened. The ways of the world are usually kind of like the island in Pinocchio where all the boys get to go and play until they turn into donkeys. Okay? It looks really good at the forefront. It's easy. There's like 3 or 4, maybe 7 steps at most to get to this. And then once you do that, then you don't realize there's been a bait and a switch. To be a person who would identify then, if these are the world's ways and means, what are God's kingdom ways and means so that I can intentionally pursue these while everything in me tries to do these? Paul describes it saying there's a battle where it's like part of me wants to do the stuff that I don't want to do. Other parts of me wants to do the stuff that I know I want to do. And it's like this war going on in between us. So oftentimes in modern culture, or as I like to say, cartoons, it'll show up in a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other side. It's not quite nearly that visible. But there is this internal struggle. Are you familiar with the struggle? The part that when you know, I want to do this, and then you decide, but I don't want to do this. It's like you could go and skip 4 or 5 meals in a row just because I'm not hungry. I'm working, doing this other stuff. Then you can decide, you know what? I'm going to dedicate my breakfast time to praying and I'm going to fast. And then you realize you might die if you don't eat something. All of a sudden, when we try and say yes to God and no to our flesh, the immediate result is our flesh goes, excuse me, I'm going to die. You have to feed me. Please take care of me. And our flesh is so close to us, we can feel it. And so it's like, well, maybe it was a bad idea for me to fast. I just feel so attacked and weak. It's been like 7 minutes. I just want to be able to do this. Or it's like, you know what? I'm going to set aside time to pray. We could be thinking about God all we want until we set aside time to pray. And what happens? Everything distracts us. People start texting us who haven't texted us in 10 years. Oh, what is this? Oh, and then we think, oh, there's that game on the phone. And pretty soon we wasted 2.5 hours messing around with stuff and we were distracted. Okay, I'm going to get back. I'm going to pray. We get to learn over time. And part of it is developing discipline. But a lot of it's just saying, I'm going to feed my spirit and I'm going to starve my flesh. Anything you don't feed will die. Anything. Look at the plants in our house. Anything that we don't feed will die. Anything we do feed will grow. It can be very difficult and be very challenging, but living for Christ is this long obedience in the same direction. And it's not a point of suffering and pain so much as it is discovering why we're on the planet, what makes life worth living. So Psalm 126, here we go. It seemed like a dream, too good to be true when God returned Zion's exiles. We laughed, we sang. We couldn't believe our good fortune. We were the talk of the nations. God was wonderful to them. God was wonderful to us. We are one happy people. And now, God, do it again. Bring rains to our drought-stricken lives. So those who planted their crops in despair will shout hurrahs at the harvest. So those who went off with heavy hearts will come home laughing with armloads of blessing. We are one happy people. It's kind of funny if you look through the Old Testament, the Israelites don't seem happy. They're really good at a couple of things, shepherding and complaining over and over and over again. Something happened. Israel would, if one of the reasons that the devil's not really mentioned much, especially early on in the Bible, is because if God had introduced a concept like the devil saying there is an enemy out here who's looking to wipe you out, the Israelites and all of their naivete at best and their willingness to pursue every other religion at worst, they would have been in a spot where they would have probably worshipped, because they would, anytime they came across a group of people who worship something different, they just add that to their pantheon. And there came a point where God said, the reason you get this land, this promised land, is because of worship. If you do not continue to worship me, you lose the land. And so they were conquered by a series of conquerors from Assyria and Babylon and people all over the place. They scattered Israel everywhere. And there was a prophecy that came to a guy named Jeremiah. And Jeremiah says, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. And we get all excited about that. We put it on bumper stickers. We say, God's got a future for us. The rest of that verse says, and so all of you people have been scattered all over. People who are living in Babylon, make yourself at home because you're not going anywhere for 70 years. Does that sound like good news? Hey, you guys want deliverance? It's coming 70 years down the road. Won't affect you. It'll affect your kids. So it's hope in the future. 70 years later, they end up being released to go back and to rebuild Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the wall. The story, you can find that in Ezra and Nehemiah. The writer of the Psalms here is looking at this saying, We were so happy. We were so excited. It seemed like it was too good to be true. If all you'd ever known was captivity, and now once not only you're going to be sent back to your homeland, but you're going to be sent back with orders from the king whose government took you away to send you go back, who's going to rebuild your homeland and going to be on his dime. This is awesome. At some point, over and over and over again, waking up in captivity, waking up in slavery, it's not something that is exciting. We look forward to. What are we going to do today? Whatever the master tells us to do. Okay, I'm really looking forward to vacation. Slaves don't get vacation. One day, it's like you guys are going home. And it seemed like a dream. It seemed like too good to be true. Talking to Uncle Mordecai, it's like, hey, Mordecai, you can't tell us we can go back home. That joke wore out like 70 years ago. Don't tell us, yeah, we're released. It's like, no, really, it's true. Have you ever received news that was so good you had to, like, verify it? Multiple sources? I can remember when Joni and I were going through the Home Affordable Refinance Program, and it took us a year and a half, and we finally, I'm in Virginia because I was having here's a rubber band stretched really thin, ready to snap. That rubber band's name was Louie. And I felt like ready to snap. There was a lot of stuff going on. So I had this week away meeting with my counselor. Phenomenal time. Feeling a little bit energized. A scale of 1 to 10, I was like at a 1.5 coming back. And so it felt much better, much better. And I can remember getting a call from Joni in the Roanoke Airport. Roanoke, Virginia, one of the first settlements in the United States, but also one of the smallest cities and airports in the world. I'm sitting in that airport, and Joni calls me on my handy, and she says, I just got off the phone, and she's bawling her eyes out. I'm thinking, oh, no, what happened? And she says, we got approved. And I was like, I need context. I've been away for a week. What's going on? She says, no, we've been approved. We got our mortgage refinance approved. Our payment ended up dropping just by half. And it's like, are you sure? She says, yes. And she's crying. She tried to tell the story. I can't understand a word. And finally, can you give me the number of the person you talked to? And so she did. And I called him and said, now, I heard you've been talking to my wife. And supposedly we got approved. And we've been through this process in a year and a half. And I need to hear it from you. And he said, what your wife told you is exactly right. You got approved. And then he said, and this is the part where she started yelling, hallelujah, praise Jesus. So if you want to do that, you can do that too. And I can remember sitting down as I got off the phone with this guy. And I just sat and I wept. I couldn't believe what was happening. It seemed too good to be true. The writer of the Psalms is tapping into that moment when people had been delivered from something they never thought they were going to be delivered from. When they were getting to experience the freedom that they never thought they would experience. And so they were happy. Finding out, guess what, we're not slaves anymore. Oh, cool. That's really good. I'm happy. No, this is like full-on Hobbit dancing on tables type of stuff that's happening. You know, it comes in pints. We're going to we're going for it. They're having a good time. Pretty soon, everybody's talking about God delivered the Israelites. This is the past. The writer brings us to, we are one happy people. Why are we happy? Because our hope isn't in us. We've been in bad situation after bad situation over and over and over again. Yet we have a God who's delivered us. And now, the prayer. Do it again. We're in trouble. Bring rains to our drought-stricken lives. So those who planted their crops in despair will shout hurrahs at the harvest. You will always plant in a season that's different than when you harvest. For people who live in an agrarian society, if you ever read the Little House on the Prairie books, it goes into great detail about this. I'd highly recommend it. You might start calling people Pa and Ma, but you know, there's worse things. I actually called my dad Pa and my mom Ma for a long time. I've been healed from Little House on the Prairie. It's a really good series. But in the agrarian society, when it would come down towards the end of, after the harvest, and they're heading towards the spring, people would have seed left over to save for planting the next year. There were times when they would have to look in their cupboard and see, we don't have much food, if at all. All we've got is the seed wheat over here that we're saving for next year. So when they were able to save it, and they're going out to plant, Imagine going out to plant. You can't eat. Your kids can't eat. There's no hope of any provision coming. And all you have is this seed wheat, which you could turn into grape nuts. You could turn into Wheaties. You could turn into food that you're going to be able to live on. But instead, you're going to, by faith, plant this seed in the ground because you know there's going to come a time in the future when you will reap a harvest. And so they're doing this. They're not like, we could be eating this. Instead, we're going to starve ourselves and we're going to plant and it'll be joyful. No. They're planting. They're sowing in the ground, weeping. Because their present circumstances do not tell them everything's wonderful, everything's great. It's like, well, just do this and then God will act immediately. Actually, it'll take several weeks-ish to see the results of what you're doing. So they get to plant in times of despair. Harvest time, something changes. They get to see the results of what they had invested with their faith and putting into the ground. And when they're harvesting, it says, they harvest with shouts of hurrah. They get to come home laughing with armloads of blessing. And I don't know if the picture here that the psalmists are doing ties in directly to, well, they're going through a famine or what. But the lesson that we get to learn is this. Many times in our relationship with God, we get to look back on, God, you did great things to us before and in the lives of Christian people before. And now we're in a situation where we are in great need. We need you to act on our behalf. And we get to take steps of faith that don't have an immediate payoff. And those steps of faith may feel like they're costing us everything. We're losing everything that we know and everything's being peeled away. But the promise that comes when we will be doing this and investing these things, we will see that God is faithful. And whatever we have sown, we will see a harvest reaped later on. And it's a lot more fun to reap when you've been planting good stuff than it is to sow. But the promise is, you will always reap what you sow. Always. Galatians tells us, don't get tired of doing good, but keep pushing on. Because if you don't give up, you will reap a harvest of righteousness. It is a guarantee. The time in between may seem tortuous. It may seem like you're alone, but you're not. God's with you. God's strengthening you. And where you end up going, God takes you places you would never have thought you'd end up. So, Psalm 127. If God doesn't build the house, its builders only build shacks. If God doesn't guard the city, the night watchman might as well nap. It's useless to rise early and go to bed late and work your worried fingers to the bone. Don't you know he enjoys giving rest to those he loves? Don't you see that children are God's best gift, the fruit of the womb, his generous legacy? Like a warrior's fistful of arrows are the children of a vigorous youth. Oh, how blessed are you parents with your quivers full of children. Your enemies don't stand a chance against you. You'll sweep them right off your doorstep. Anybody besides you, it's like he's talking about building houses. He's talking about guarding cities. He's talking, and then the kids. He's not just having this moment where, hey, here's where we're going. Here, what is this? Well, one of the most important things that sets apart God's people from the rest of the world is the concept of rest and the idea of God's work. First thing that we see in the Bible, in the beginning, God created. God worked. The problem is God's work, God's values, God's ethics fly counter to our own cultural norms for work. Our effort and accomplishment in themselves do not justify anything. You don't know how hard I worked on that. Am I working on or building in God's ways, values, or am I functioning according to the values of our world? We need to be really careful, kind of exploring how does sin or the advent of wrong into our lives distort our human nature? Adam in the Garden of Eden, when he and Eve sinned, both receive a curse. Adam's curse was that the ground would be cursed. It would be hard for him to get anything to grow from it. Instead, he would get thorns and thistles. Nevada said you would only get any food by the sweat of your brow, and that until you died, this is just going to be your lot. So it's like one of the things that ends up happening, instead of work being something where we flow with a good rhythm and we flow with in God's pattern where he says he created in the 6 days and on the seventh day he rested, created holy space and says, I give my rest to my people. That identifying characteristic between God's people and the people around him is they took a day to rest. And the writers of the Psalms are looking at this and they're declaring these things of, if you are trying to build something that God isn't asking you to build, you're wasting your time. If you're attempting to do something to guard your possessions and it's not God inspired, it falls away. It's like you're wasting your time. The nations rage trying to gather and to amass and to get as much stuff as possible. And God says, you'll get more with 6 days and a day of rest than not. And so as I was going through these studies, I had a hard time when he gets to, don't you see that children are God's best gift? Blessed are you parents with your quivers full of children. I like that. And at the same time, I wrestle and dear friends who have not been able to have babies. And I look at that and I think, I don't want to start going like, well, you know how a couple weeks ago we were reading about how God's our deliverer and our fortress? What about the times when he's not been our deliverer and our fortress? No, let's talk about that. Well, just like in those passages where it's not meant to be this final definitive explanation on why bad things happen and why good things happen in certain ways. This isn't about where there's a cause and effect. If you're not having kids or weren't able to have them, that somehow you're suffering and God's not blessing you. No, this is simply an acknowledgement. Kids are great. And more than that, as I dug through this, I tried to explain, I was wrestling through it with my wife last night, talking about this. It's like, where this seems to be going, in talking about the comparison of, you know, the kind of work you do versus the kind of work God does. And then it's almost like here we have an explanation. It's almost like the psalmist says, now take, for example, kids. Okay? With kids, God has said, you know, from the very beginning to Noah, be fruitful and multiply. So go to work. God says, be fruitful and multiply. Go to work. He invites humanity. You know, we do not create our own children. But he invites us to participate in a act between husband and wife that does lead to or can lead to babies. Never in my life would I have considered that work. Okay? See where we're going? It's like the psalmist says, this is God-style work. It gives us an idea. Okay, so you're saying what I think you're saying. It's like, yeah, that's what it's saying. Look at the kids. And in some ways, to take this to another level, God's work does not just acquire, does not just build, does not just amass. It's about relationship. It's about investing in people. It's about knowing and being known. And it's a reminder for the Israelites who are, again, spread all over the world. They're coming back together. What sets us apart? Rest. We rest. And then being able to look and say, this is God's idea of work. He invites us to invest into relationship and in people and in each other. How do I do? Is that okay? Okay. Nice. I worry about those kind of things. I want to touch on what the scripture says and not try and make it say something it doesn't, but I also don't want to dance around stuff and like, well, I don't want to touch on that because it could be potentially awkward. You know, part of that, being raised in a Christian home where you get taught certain things in certain ways, and at various points, I don't remember ever having conversations about sex or intimacy at any given time in my life until I had them with my wife. We're trying to figure, you know, theoretically discussing things like that. Practically. But for us, if we acknowledge it, there's areas in our relationship with God that can be maybe challenging for us to address or challenging us to talk about, we have the opportunity to not, you know, dance around them, but to actually just kind of wade into it and recognize that we may bring our own personal weirdness into stuff, but God's not weird. And there's life and hope and peace and relationship that comes out of that.
has been a podcast presentation of Hillside Foursquare Church in Reno, Nevada. You can reach us at web@hillside4.org.